Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. Now that Pesach has passed, it's time to think about joining us in Jerusalem this summer for one of the Pardes summer programs. Our premier program is the Pardes 3-week summer program, offered in June, July, and August. Each summer session features 5 or more levels, so matter your skill and background levels, you'll have a great time. The summer program is flexible. You can attend the sessions full-time or half-time, either mornings only or afternoons only. Participants generally range from their 20s through 50s. Another program focused for people with only a week to study is the Pardes Executive Learning Seminar. This year, it's July 1st through 5th. The seminar is geared towards business executives, professionals, and community leaders. The program will be led this year by Rabbi Meir Schweiger. Pardes also offers a 3-day spiritual retreat, this year Tuesday, June 26th through Thursday, June 28th. This year's focus for the retreat is Mapping Our Spiritual Path. The program is open to everyone 19 through 99. Over the years, I've had the blessing to attend each of the programs I've just mentioned. All were superb. I've also found that the Pardes difference is often the faculty. They genuinely want to learn your name and assist you on your Jewish journey. I urge you to make a plan now to study in Jerusalem this summer. You'll have an amazing time, rich in experience and knowledge. Complete details are on the Pardes website, pardes.org.il. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses a double Torah portion of Parshiyot Tetzaria Metzora. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member for Pardes and serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
This week's Torah reading is a double portion, Parshiyot Tetzaria and Metzora. As I mentioned last year in the podcast, the topic of these two Parshiyot is ritual purity and impurity associated with one's body. Or as it is said in Hebrew, Tuma Hayotzeit Migufo Shel Adam. There is a very interesting structure to the Parshiyot. Chiastic structure, ABBA. Chapter 12 begins with a discussion of Tum'at Yoledet, ritual impurity resulting from childbirth. Chapter 13 discusses Tzara'at, generally translated as leprosy, although a number of commentaries point out that this is a misnomer. And in fact, there is no correlation between the symptoms of Tzara'at and the symptoms of leprosy. Chapter 13 discusses 2 forms of Tzara'at. Tzara'at of the body, Tzara'at HaGuf. And then at the end of the chapter, from verse 48 onwards, Tzara'at Begadim, leprosy shown or displayed in one's clothing. Chapter 14 begins with a discussion of the process of purification of one who has Tzara'at HaGuf. And in the middle, from verse 33 on, it discusses Tzara'at HaBatim, leprosy of the homes. In chapter 15, we discuss Zav, a man who has a seminal flow, which is seen to be perhaps an expression of some illness. Some commentaries want to associate it with gonorrhea. It then goes on to talk about Bal Keri, a man who has some sort of seminal ejaculation, which produces ritual impurity. And from verse 19 on, we speak about a woman who is impure, Nida, menstruation, and then later on, Zava, bleeding in excess of one's menstrual cycle. As I mentioned, the pattern is ABBA. We start off talking about a woman who gives birth. We conclude speaking about women in terms of their menstrual cycle, excess bleeding. That's preceded by a discussion of men whose sexual organ produces ritual impurity. And sandwiched in the middle is a discussion of all the forms of tzara'at and the process of their purification. Today I would like to examine in more detail tumat yoledet, impurity as a result of childbirth. Chapter 12, verse 2. God says to Moshe, speak to the Jewish people and tell them, if a woman should have seed and bears a son, she will be impure for a period of 7 days, as the days of her nidah, illness, she will be impure. And on the eighth day, the skin of his foreskin shall be circumcised. And then the woman has a period of 33 days, which are known as days of purity. And during that, the 7 days of impurity and the subsequent 33 days of purity, she is not allowed to touch holy produce. She is not allowed to enter the temple until her days of purity have been completed. If a woman should have a girl, the periods of time are doubled. She is impure for 14 days and then has a 66-day period of sitting on pure blood, so that altogether she has an 80-day period after childbirth, in contrast to the 40-day period when she has a boy. In each situation, when that period of time has elapsed, on day number 41 or on day number 81, the woman needs to bring sacrifices. Sacrifices in verse 7, which are described as on the one hand atoning for her, and on the other hand purifying her. In verse 6, she brings a sheep as a burnt offering, a pigeon or a turtle dove as a sin offering, and then finally in verse 8, if she does not have the financial means to bring a sheep, she can simply bring a set of turtle doves or pigeons, one for a burnt offering and one for a sin offering. And the priest shall atone for her, and she will be pure. There are a number of questions raised by this section. First question, why should the Torah begin the discussion of Tumashi Yotzeit Migufo Shel Adam with the example of a woman who gives birth? To perhaps sharpen that question, if in verse 2 we say that the woman is impure for 7 days as the woman who menstruates, then logically the Torah should begin with a discussion of ritual impurity caused by menstruation, as it discusses later on in the end of chapter 15. And then go on to talk about the woman who gives birth. Menstruant impurity is much more common, is the norm. So why did the Torah begin by talking about impurity of birth and only at the very end speak about menstrual impurity? Second question. When the period of impurity / purity ends, the woman is obligated to bring sacrifices, a burnt offering, a sin offering. The Torah speaks of atonement. But what sin is there in the context of childbirth? Intuitively, we see bearing children as being a blessing, as the fulfillment of a commandment, as something extremely positive. So why should such a woman become impure? Why should such a woman have to bring a sin offering to be atoned for? The Talmud in Masechet Nidah makes the following observation and actually asks the question which I posed. Why should a woman bring a sin offering when she gives birth? And the answer is because perhaps during the process of childbirth, perhaps during the period of pregnancy, the woman had terrible pains, terrible suffering, and she had second thoughts about her pregnancy. Perhaps she had second thoughts about bringing children into the world in the future. She regrets the fact that she is giving birth. Rather than seeing giving birth as being a blessing, she sees it as a curse. On other occasions, I've discussed the idea of tuma, ritual impurity. Every form of ritual impurity is associated with death, some form of death. The classic example is ritual impurity generated by a dead body. Whoever comes in contact with the dead body is in the same frame of reference as the dead body, the same house as the dead body, becomes ritually impure for a period of 7 days. Why? Ritual impurity is an expression of the loss of human dignity, of the loss of one's tzelem Elokim. Obviously, this is what happens at death. A dead body no longer has its divine image. The soul has departed. That's what generates the tum'ah. In the case of a woman who gives birth, the tum'ah is a result of the original curse of Adam and Eve, specifically of Eve. In Bereshit, in chapter 3, verse 16, "And God said to the woman, I will increase your sadness and your labor. With sadness you will bear children." Twice, the word sadness appears. What is the curse of the woman? Giving birth, which should be the most joyful experience of a woman's life, the most powerful expression of her creative capacity, the ultimate expression of her empowerment to be godlike, to actually bring into existence and nurture a human being. At that very moment, the woman also experiences her ultimate powerlessness. At the moment of childbirth, the woman is on the cusp of potential death. Death of the newborn, death of the woman herself. Should complications arise in the process, it could be absolutely fatal. Even if there is not the element of death, actual death, there is the mini-death of the pain, of the suffering. There is all the afterbirth which comes out, which takes away from perhaps the aesthetic side of bringing a new life into the world. Hence, when a woman gives birth, she is confronted with the fundamental question of life and death and needs to affirm life. As the Talmud notes, it could very well be that at the very moment when the woman should be experiencing ultimate joy, she experiences depression. At the very moment when the woman should feel empowered by bringing life into the world and seek to bring even more life into the world, she may be overwhelmed by the difficulty of childbirth, perhaps traumatized, and have second thoughts, take a vow that she will never do this again. For this reason, the woman is impure and needs to go through a process of purification to affirm her love of life, to affirm her joy of bringing this new life into the world, to not allow the pain and the sadness to be the dominant feature that causes her to sink into depression and to perhaps affirming death by not wanting to bring more life into the world. I'd like to add another dimension to this, the idea of kapara, of atonement. On the one hand, the woman is atoning for the possibility that maybe she had misgivings about giving birth. Maybe she vowed never to do it again. But one could ask, what if I have a situation where from beginning to end, a woman is absolutely ecstatic, completely upbeat about having a new baby, then where is the need for atonement? And perhaps on a more mystical note, the atonement is not for this woman, but for the situation in the world that was created by the original woman, Eve. Namely, when Eve ate of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, this created a shattered world, reflected in the curse of Eve by the fact that the world is no longer a place of total joy. The world is a place where joy and sadness are intermingled, and where there's the very real possibility that sadness overpowers the joy. And even if this particular woman is filled with joy, the world around her is not. And therefore, it is important for the woman to realize that when she gives birth, she brings life into the world. But more than that, by doing so, she is trying to strive to transform the world into a place where there is no longer sadness, only joy. Bringing the sacrifices is a petition to God. Accept my sacrifice. Enable us to create a more perfect world. The Tumah is not a reflection necessarily of a sin of the woman. The Tumah is perhaps a reflection of the state of the world. We live in a world which is still imperfect. We live in a world where we don't automatically experience joy and life, where there's a lot of pain that is associated with them, where we have to be able to somehow overcome the pain and overcome the sadness and actively affirm what is truly positive in the world. Why is it that in the midst of this section, we discuss circumcision in verse 3? Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch quotes a number of passages from the Talmud that make an analogy between the foreskin and impurity. One who is impure cannot partake of sacrifices. One who has a foreskin cannot partake of sacrifices. One who has a foreskin cannot do the temple service, just as one who is impure cannot do the temple service. The foreskin is also a symbol of an unredeemed world. The whole concept of Brit Milah is where human beings perfect their world, where somehow they become partners with God in creating a more perfect reality. Interestingly, in the case of Brit Milah, you need to cut off the foreskin. On some level, it seems you need to create something painful. You need to be able to perhaps even remove something in order to create a more perfect reality. When the woman has a boy, she's impure for 7 days. For a girl, 14 days. The question is begged, why the difference? And Rabbi Hirsch notes that when the woman has a double period of impurity for a girl, it is a way of her vicariously experiencing impurity not only of herself, but on behalf of her daughter. It is perhaps a way of telling her of her mission to educate her daughter in the same way that she needs to acknowledge the imperfection of the world and to strive for a more perfect world, to see as her goal to bring more life into the world. At the moment of birth of her daughter, she should see her role as a mother who passes on that tradition to her daughter and hence experiences the tumah of her daughter as well. But in the case of a boy, that message of taking control of one's destiny, of bringing life into the world, of consecrating oneself is taken over by the Father. For 7 days, the Son is with his mother, but on the 8th day, the Father then takes over and introduces his Son, initiates his Son into his role of perfecting the world. It is very interesting that ritual impurity is associated with one's sexual organs, can be produced by one's sexual organs. My understanding is that one's sexual organs are not seen as inherently impure, negative, but rather they have the capacity for that negativity. To phrase it differently, one's sexual organs, or perhaps we should say, how one uses their sexual organs, can be done either in a very positive way, to bring more life into the world, either by physically producing a new child, or at the very least, to create a more intimate relationship between a man and a woman, which can somehow heighten their human dignity. But the same sexual organs can also be used simply for self-gratification, simply to express the most base elements in an individual, or in the worst case scenario, to be an expression of abuse. And perhaps to illustrate this with a very famous story, in Bereishit, in chapter 34, verse 13, the story where Shechem rapes Dinah, it says that the brothers heard, or I should say, excuse me, the brothers respond to Shechem and to Hamor's father deceptively and speak to them. Who are they speaking to? To the one who defiled their sister. Shechem raped Dinah. In the act of raping Dinah, he stripped her, not just literally, but metaphorically, of her human dignity. He reduced her to being an object. That is the state of her tum'ah. Later on in Vayikra, in chapter 18, in the section that discusses the prohibited sexual relationships, it says, don't engage in these practices and don't become defiled as a result of them. And in fact, the place where this comes up is specifically in chapter 18, verse 23, when it says, do not plant your seed in an animal, do not sleep with an animal, to become defiled through it. If I have sexual relationships with an animal, that cannot be an intimate I-thou relationship. I do not bring out the tzelem Elohim of the animal, the divine image of the animal. By doing that, I strip myself of my divine image. I become no different than the animal. I will not produce a human being as a result of that. I will not further the divine image, further life. This is an act of tumah. What the Torah is trying to show us by the laws of Tumah Shiyotzei Migufo Shel Adam is that a person has to somehow define for himself what is life, what is death, what reflects my human dignity, what strips me of my human dignity. In what situations do I allow the reality to overwhelm me, to possess me? Do I become an object of the forces around me? Or to what degree am I able to confront those forces, overcome those forces, assert my free will, control those forces and channel them to create life, to create a better world, a more perfect world, a world which reflects and invites the presence of God? All the laws of ritual purity and impurity that appear in our parshiot are relevant only in a time when we have a temple and have ramifications vis-a-vis the temple, vis-a-vis sacrifices, holy objects, so that all these laws, in effect, are not operative nowadays. And yet, nevertheless, the message of these laws still ring true. We still live in a world where life and death commingle. We still live in a world where we have to ask ourselves, what do we do with the unbelievable capacity we have to bring life and joy, the divine image, into our reality? Or how much do we take those gifts of life and either eliminate them or allow ourselves to be so overwhelmed by the negative forces around us that we become the object of those forces rather than the masters of our destiny? May we learn from these parshiot how to affirm life, how to grapple with those difficulties and triumph, and thereby create a more perfect reality. Shabbat shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send your email to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.